In last lecture, I spent some time discussing persistent current in superconductors. And now I'll show some effects that are very important. Yes? What?
Can I ask a question?
Okay, sure.
They have a superconductor. They have high voltage to the superconductor. What would happen to
them? Okay, that's a very good question because it's ill posed. You cannot apply a voltage to a superconductor. Okay, what you can do is you can pass a current to a superconductor. Whether or not it develops a voltage, it's up to him. The same way as in a superfluid, you cannot apply a pressure difference. Now, if a superconductor is connected in series with a normal lead, all the voltage will fall on the normal lead, and the superconductor will carry zero voltage. So the superconductor cannot support a voltage drop unless, and that's something that I'll get to, I hope, to tomorrow, and I think I will get to tomorrow, unless voltages move around. So being able to apply a voltage is essentially the same statement as vortices can move around in a superconductor and give you a stress. So what you can do to a superconductor is you can pass a current. And this you can do by introducing a magnetic field in the hole of a loop, and then persistent current will flow, or even connecting it to a regular battery through leads. And if you do the Kirchhoff's equations, you'll get voltage drops everywhere except on a superconductor where the current will flow without the voltage drop. Okay? So that's the... flux quantization, actually, we discussed essentially the geometry already, and it's essentially a statement about being able to minimize the energy of a thermodynamic system in the presence of a vector potential. So if I have a ring, and I'll put some kind of a flux phi in here, right? I can give a condition for which the energy here will be unchanged by the flux here. The energy here will be unchanged if the energy that we calculated previously, which was 1 over 2m, okay, so I'll write the full equation. Actually, I'll do it this way. This is the energy functional as a function of our field phi. And if I now minimize this part to obtain the magnitude of phi squared, which is phi is equal to square root of rho zero e to the I phi, and rho zero is mu divided by g, then essentially all that I can play with here is the phase. So if I put a gauge field A, which is non-zero, there is a possibility of minimizing this by having the phase wind around. So if I want to write this in terms of magnitude and phase, it'll look like there'll be a magnitude here coming out. So it'll be rho zero divided by 2m. This h bar also I want to take out. So I'll have h bar squared, and now d dx, and inside here I'll have grad phi. I'll get an I from there and an I from here, which in the absolute value squared will vanish, so it will not be important. So I'll have a minus q divided by h bar that I took outside, c a, This is a vector squared. This vector could be written, essentially, it has units of one of a length. It could be written as m times a velocity squared. Sorry, m squared times the velocity. Divided by, this is so it's moment, yeah, divided by h bar, right, squared. Yeah, this is one over length scale, so one over length square times So I have this expression here, and then I have stuff that's not important because it's all just a function of rho. So it's mu rho 0 plus g over 2 rho 0 squared. This is what I want to minimize in here. This is small phi as a function of x. And it will be minimized only if I wind the phase, if the phase is not constant. If, in fact, the phase winds exactly like A. So I can make this positive functional minimum if I set V equal to 0, V magnitude equal to 0. So V equal to 0 in the ring will give us 0 kinetic energy. But it doesn't mean that the phase is constant. It means that the phase is now tied to A. So grad phi is simply going to be equal to Q over H bar C A. However, A is related to the flux inside. A is given by an integral dl dot A is equal to the flux. Okay? Now I can write using this equation, this is equal to h bar c divided by q times an integral dl dot grad phi. Now phi is a phase. If I take the integral of grad phi on any closed loop, then I'll essentially describe a rotation of a unit vector in the plane. And if I start with a unit vector in some direction, and I rotate it, no matter how much I rotate it and what speed I rotate it, it has to come back to the same direction. I can say that it has to rotate 2 pi times an integer. So this is 2 pi times an integer times this h bar c divided by q. This is the simplest example of topology. This integral is topological. It measures the winding of the phase around the loop, or the winding of the phase around this loop. So this is my dl dot a that's equal to phi, and at the same time equal to 2 pi k times something which has, of course, dimensions of flux, h bar c divided by q. Now, h bar times 2 pi is called h. So it's k times h c over q. H c over q is our friend, the unit of flux, the flux quantum phi 0. So what did we learn? We learned that the energy is minimized if the phase winds around. Of course, the phase has to run around integer number of times, but if the gauge field A contains an integer number of fluxes. That's exactly like in the Byers-Young theorem, saying that when the hole contains an integer number of flux quantum, the spectrum comes back to exactly the same spectrum as if there was no flux at all, in which case the ground state energy is lowest. And this is an effect that could be measured to actually tell us what is the flux quantum. One thing that's important in measuring this flux quantum is to measure the charge Q. All the time I said there is a boson of charge Q. What is that charge? Well, when people did this experiment, the experiment actually involved taking a cylinder, putting a magnetic field inside, and measuring, in a sense, by essentially connecting leads here, measuring these leads actually were Josephson's junctions. I don't want now to describe the effects of tunneling inside here, but okay. So an expression that's actually a measurement that's actually something that's easy to explain is not to measure resistivity, but they measured magnetization. In other words, they measured this velocity. They measured this current. How do you do that? Well, you put a magnetic field inside here, but then you also put in the same hole, you put a measuring device of magnetic field. The difference between the magnetic field that you inserted, which you know what it is, and the magnetic field coming from the circulating currents here, from these velocities, will be magnetization. And magnetization could be measured as a function of this field. And what they found was that there were oscillations. The magnetization oscillated, and it oscillated in the periodicity of one flux quantum at the time. But the flux quantum was the flux quantum you get, it's called the Josephson flux quantum, when you put Q equal to twice the electron charge. And that was a signal that the bosons that superconductors are made out of are pairs of electrons. We derived the bosons that we're using here, if you remember, from the negative U-Hubbard model, and the bosons were pairs of electrons. They were C-dagger, creation of two electrons at a time. At the time, there wasn't a microscopic theory, not the negative U-Hubbard model, not the BCS theory. So the fact that it was measured as with periodicity of Q equal to 2E was the first indication that there's pairing going on between the electrons. And this is a very accurate measurement of the electron charge, has no corrections to it, okay? This is actually a fundamental constant that comes out in this experiment without any correction due to solid state physics. It's the electron charge as measured for single electrons in the vacuum, unrenormalized by interactions or by disorder or by anything. So this experiment it can be explained essentially as phase winding to cancel the effects of the gauge field in a superconductor. Flux quantization is one effect. The second effect is the Meissner effect. The Meissner effect is a different geometry. It's a geometry that you take a slab of a superconductor and you have a magnetic field here, BZ, going out of the plane. This is the X direction, this is the Y direction. Okay, and now, again, you write the current operator. The current operator is equal to Q, the charge, H bar rho zero, divided by M, grad phi, minus Q over H bar C, A. This is the, again, this is the momentum, right? H bar times this is the momentum. And divided by M is the velocity. So you have velocity times density, that's a current density. And this is an electric current density when you multiply it by Q. Okay, now you do simple electrodynamics. Okay, sorry. Before you do that, you say something about grad phi. Grad phi is a function that describes the variation of a phase. And there are two kinds of solutions for grad phi. One of them is called laminar flow, is you put a condition that rot grad phi is zero. That means there are no vortices. Phi is a potential then. If it's rotor is zero, if rot grad phi is zero, then phi is, grad phi is an electric field, or it's a vector field that's conserving, and you can integrate and get a potential. So this is called laminar flow or potential flow in hydrodynamics. Why do I mention hydrodynamics here? Because remember that this guy is related to a velocity. And velocity is exactly the field that you discuss in hydrodynamics. So this expression is well known in hydrodynamics, saying that there is laminar flow. When you say that, it's essentially a statement about energetics of this functional. Because if you do put vortices in the system, which we'll do next, it costs you energy. Every vortex costs you some finite energy. So I don't want to pay that energy, and therefore I'm assuming laminar flow. If I assume laminar flow, what will happen? If I take rotor of J, it'll be rotor of grad phi, but rotor of grad phi is zero. So I'll get minus just this contribution, Q squared, H will cancel, rho zero divided by MC, rot A. But rot A is nothing but the magnetic field B. Let me do it again. Rotor of J minus Q squared rho zero MC, rotor of B. Now we use Maxwell equation. Rot B is equal to 4 pi J divided by C. So if I use that, then rotor of, this is B, will be just 4 pi J over C. So I'll have 4 pi J, and here I'll have a C squared. Now we've got a vector equation, differential equation of J with itself. Rotor of J is equal to something times J. What's the solution of this equation in the simple geometry I showed you here? Well, if I make life simple and I tell you what the directions are, if B is going in the Z direction, then J can flow in the Y direction. So J will be some J of X times Y hat. That's assuming the vectors are like that. Then rotor J becomes nothing but the second derivative with respect to X of J. So I have a differential equation, D squared of X, J of X, equal to minus 4 pi Q squared rho zero divided by MC squared times J. Solution, E to the minus X over lambda times J zero. What's the solution for B of Z, which also depends on X? Same thing, E to the minus X over lambda times BZ of zero. I get an exponentially decaying current and an exponentially decaying magnetic field. If this is my magnetic field, it exponentially decays into the sample. It shields the magnetic field completely after a distance, lambda. What is lambda? Lambda minus 2 is this coefficient, Q squared 4 pi Q squared rho 0 divided by MC squared. It's called London's penetration depth. And it measures the quantities rho zero, the mass, and now let's say we know the charge and we know the velocity of light, so that's not really the way to measure it. But it tells you something about the density of carriers and their mass. Yes, question.
I'm trying to piece together the process that just happened. You said grad phi is a function of phi, and there are two types of solutions. Namely, is it that we can stick grad phi as a function into an equation, two types of equations?
I'm making an assumption about laminar flow. This assumption I'm making.
Okay, so we're focusing on that and ignoring the other types of solutions.
Yes. We'll do the other types later. This particular solution is in a phase of matter called Meissner phase that has no vortices. Vortices are exactly places where cross grad phi is non-zero. That's a definition of a vortex. Yes?
So is this actually you fix the page?
No. I'm dealing with a gauge invariant object here. Okay. So I can add gradient terms here and to here. All those gradient terms will fall away when I do the cross, when I take the rotor. So I'm not fixing the gauge. I'm solving the physical objects which are gauge invariant. Current is gauge invariant. Magnetic field, electric fields are gauge invariant. What is not gauge invariant is A. That's true. But notice that A dropped out of the equation. So I'm safe. But you're absolutely right that this is one thing that you have to really be careful about. Gauge invariance.
So here you just make an assumption of this laminar flow.
Yes. Laminar flow is very, physical. In hydrodynamics, there's difference between when liquid flows in the pipe with and without vortices. And we're discussing this solution. So this solution says that the magnetic field will be screened. It will actually decay. The magnetic field here has a spatial dependence. If you want to draw it, it looks like this. This is x, and this is bz of x. And the currents are built such that they cancel the magnetic field. It's all worked out into these equations. So the Meissner effect is an effect that happens no matter how you prepare the system. This is a bit different than the stuff I talked to you about persistent currents. In the persistent currents, I told you if you start the system with zero flux in the middle and you increase the flux, the current will flow. Right? That was the persistent current. It cannot decay to its ground state, so you'll have a metastable system with strong currents flowing. And you could do two experiments there. You can either increase the field when the system is superconductor and get the persistent current, or you can start with a system that's in the normal metallic state, not superconducting, put in a large field, no persistent current, exactly like you learn when you have a finite resistivity, all the currents decay. There's not going to be any persistent currents after you put the field inside. And then you cool it below the superconducting temperature, and again, you'll stay with no persistent current because the system will be the fluxes will be invisible inside. That's a different situation than what happens in the Meissner effect. In the Meissner effect, if you cool the system in a magnetic field, okay, in the beginning, the magnetic field will go throughout the system. That's in a normal state. Magnetic field penetrates everywhere in the metal. But once you cool, this energy that you want to minimize, this first term, will start costing you a lot of energy. And in order to decrease the energy, the currents here will flow to cancel the field and to give you the Meissner effect, whether or not the field was there before you cooled or after you cooled. The system will always repel it. It will expel the field, not as a consequence of you changing the field, but as a consequence of thermodynamical minimum is to expel the field. And that's a sign that the superconductor is not just a zero-resistance metal. The zero-resistance metal can explain the first effect, even though it's very hard to explain it, because a little bit of disorder destroys it. But if you have a very, very clean metal, you say, I can induce a persistent current by an eddy current. When I change a magnetic field, I get eddy currents. And then I stop changing, and the eddy current doesn't decay. That's a naive and wrong explanation of superconductivity. It's not a zero-resistant metal. It's here showing that the currents are created. These J's are created when you're in the superconducting phase to expel the field. no matter if the field was there before you cooled or after you cooled. So field cooled and not field cooled are the same experiment. And that's the crucial difference of a superconductor and a metal. Yeah. Did I make a wrong sign? There's a minus here?
A minus in the left. So when you did the double root,
I get the minus. Oh, sorry. Okay. Yes. Oh, you guys are on top of things. That's good.
Second question was,
yeah.
I'm confused. Isn't the curl of a gradient always zero? Or are we?
No. It's only zero if phi is a potential. But if phi is an angle, as we'll soon show, then it's non-zero. If you have a vortex, it's non-zero.
So A doesn't correspond, so the magnetic, the effect potential A doesn't correspond to the total magnetic field, so if you apply the magnetic field, well.
No. A is the magnetic field. It's not H, it's A. It's B.
Right. But
cross A is B, is the actual field that if you put a magnetometer, you'll measure. It's not whatever your magnet says on what's written on the magnet.
Okay?
So, the Meissner effect is completely. I gave you a very, how would you say, a very experimental and very. Nuts and bolts explanation of the what the particle physics people call Higgs phenomena. What really happened here is that in this medium, in the superconducting medium, where phi expectation value, I would say psi expectation value is not equal to zero, where I have a coefficient in front of the gradient term, a stiffness coefficient, which is this rho of zero over m. The electromagnetism looks different. The magnetic field has a finite decay. It's an exponential decay. If I wrote the electrodynamics problem of not the static magnetic field, but the electrodynamic magnetic field, I will get that there's a term that you actually can read off the equation there, which is a master. See, when I look at the first term there, and I expand it in A, so essentially what I wrote there is that the energy had a term that looked like, I just keep the A squared term, Q squared divided by H bar C, Q divided by H bar C squared times the coefficient, which was H bar squared rho 0 divided by M, 2M times A squared times phi squared. This, we replaced it by the constant, sorry, without the rho 0. This, we replaced it by the constant rho 0. So the coefficient of the A squared is all this stuff together times A squared. But once you put the electrodynamics in, you have a d mu A nu epsilon nu lambda squared. You have the F nu squared term, which is E squared plus B squared in electrodynamics, plus some mass term times, well, let's call it mass of the W times A squared. So unlike a theory which doesn't have, I'll just take this away. A theory that doesn't have this mass term, the A is massless, here, eventually, when I look at the propagation of A as a field theory, I will get that A acquired the mass. And if A acquires a mass, then of course it will have exponentially decaying correlations in real space. And we're talking about Euclidean geometry, so it also have exponentially decaying correlations in time. So this exponentially decaying e to the minus x over lambda is the spatial part of the mass. So the London penetration depth is measuring the mass of the gauge field. So the gauge field acquired a mass. And notice what else happened. This phi field essentially disappeared from the picture because, in a sense, I absorbed the superfluid phase in the definition of the longitudinal gauge field, the massive gauge field. So this is the way that gauge fields can acquire mass. The big problem in the early 70s was that we had too many gauge fields in particle physics to remediate all the interactions and all the high symmetries and everything. But there were not massless particles associated with them. And in fact, even the fermions got masses from all kinds of places that people don't know where they came from. So after the paper of, started with a paper by Schwinger that says gauge field can get the mass if they're coupled to some condensed matter or some field phi, they call it condensed matter, some field phi coming from somewhere. But he didn't explain how. Anderson explained Schwinger's paper and he said, I can give you an example where a gauge field gets a mass, and he took a metal, not a superconductor, and he showed in a metal, when you have long-range Coulomb interactions, you get screening, and the metal has a finite oscillation frequency called the plasma oscillation, and the plasma oscillation couples to the gauge field and gives the gauge field a finite mass and screens the gauge field. That's why metals screen. Okay? So the screening effect of metals is giving a mass to gauge field. And later, Higgs actually introduced this idea in particle physics by saying, oh, let's just assume that we have some kind of a vacuum that's not a simple vacuum, but a superconducting vacuum. And when you do that, you follow exactly this line of logic, and the gauge field gets a mass. Of course, you have to justify why did you assume that the vacuum is a superconductor. And that's not justified. That's just an assumption now in particle physics. But there is a scalar field which is invisible except for its effect on giving gauge field masses and actually giving all the other particles their masses and giving a relation between the masses that was confirmed beautifully. So that was the story until recently. Recently, the extra mode was found, the mode that we're not discussing here. It's called an amplitude mode, where rho fluctuates. See, I'm not discussing any fluctuations in rho here. I'm taking rho, the density, or the order parameter size, to be a constant. But it can also fluctuate, and it also has dynamics. If it fluctuates, it will fluctuate at some finite frequency, and that would be another particle, and that's the Higgs particle. So it's another manifestation of the Higgs phenomenon that was looked for and confirmed. But it's not necessary to have this fluctuation at a certain frequency in order to get this giving the gauge field the mass. That's so should separate the Higgs mechanism to give mass to gauge fields from the Higgs particle, which is another manifestation of the correctness of the theory. Yeah?
For the mass effect, they also say that the persistent current can only flow on the surface.
Say that
the current also decays.
Oh, yes, the currents will flow. Once currents flow in a system, they create a magnetic field. These currents are flowing in response to a field that's imposed on the system. The self-magnetic field that comes out of the current it causes, okay. it causes the currents to bunch up, but now I'm not really sure of what I'm saying. When you analyze the actual profile of currents in a superconductor, you really have to take into account the magnetic fields that they create. But I'm not sure it forces the current to be on the surface. I have to work out the thermodynamics of looking at the cross section and letting current flow, and then you have the current creates a magnetic field, and the magnetic field is, maybe you're right. The currents themselves have to be flowing in some distance from the edge. But actually, all the electrodynamics of superconductors are explained very well in Tinkham's book. Tinkham wrote, I think, the best book on the phenomenon of superconductivity that you can find as an experimentalist. Except for small mistakes in there, it's a good book. Yeah.
I'm not sure if you mentioned that the stiffness, sometimes the stiffness indicates there is a fine line, which means it's not exponential.
No, the stiffness gives you the exponential decay. The stiffness is the coefficient in front of the quadratic gradient term. Whatever that coefficient is, you call it stiffness.
So did you say that there is a case that you can have a finite
decay?
Is there a case you have to find?
This is a finite decay. I don't understand what you're asking.
Is exponential decay
finite decay length?
Finite decay.
Power law is when the decay length is infinite. But this is exponential. Okay. So now we're at the point where we want to describe vortices. Vortices are what happens when you put the magnetic field B to be quite large. And it always happens in two dimensions when the layer is so thin that whatever currents are flowing in it are not sufficient to change the magnetic field by much. They're not giving you screening. So all these effects I described here are in three-dimensional systems where the current density can be, or the currents themselves can be large enough to screen. Before we discuss what happens in a strong magnetic field, I want to make another subject, which is that I can induce, even on a neutral system, an effect of a magnetic field. How do I do that? So remember your elementary mechanics. If I consider equations of motion in a rotating frame. So rotating frame where I decide that the z-axis is the axis of rotation, and omega, which is omega times z, is a rotation of my system around the z-axis. What is that relevant to? That's relevant to helium in a cylinder that's rotating. What does that do to the Schrödinger equation, the equation of motion? Well, we know that there's two fictitious forces that happen, or if you want fictitious kind of terms in the Lagrangian. There's the centrifugal force, which is simply minus m omega squared times r perpendicular squared. That wants to give us an effective potential. Looks quadratic. This is r perpendicular, and it wants to throw my system, my particles away from the center. You can balance that with a confining potential. That's what they do with rotating atoms. And the confining potential can have a positive curvature, which exactly cancels this one. So this term, I assume, could be canceled, so the system would be stable by potentials. But there's another term which is much more interesting, which is the Coriolis force. So remember your Coriolis forces. Coriolis force looks like Q over C, looks like F is equal to 2m omega cross V. Okay? Now this looks extremely like a Lorentz force from a magnetic field, right? What does a Lorentz force from a magnetic field look like? It looks like, and I'm putting quotation mark, Q over C V cross B. All I need now is to identify my fictitious magnetic field with the rotation, which is physical. And that definition is simply saying that B Coriolis is equal to minus 2m divided by Q C times omega. So everything I said before about magnetic fields will now hold for neutral systems in rotating frames. It's interesting that this Coriolis force comes in a very strong way, because Coriolis force depends on velocities. And I'm going to talk about it in static situations, in ground states and so on. Why would I care about forces that care about velocities in a system that's in its ground state? The answer is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is no such thing as ignoring a force that acts on momentum, even in the ground state. Exactly like you cannot ignore the effect of a magnetic field in the ground state. If you know particles in a magnetic field, they don't sit in harmonic oscillator wave functions, or they sit in Landau levels, in wave functions that, even when they are at lowest energy, reflect the fact that the magnetic field is frustrating the kinetic energy. So what I'm going to discuss now is, what does a fixed magnetic field do to the functional of the condensate field? And I'm going to go back and forth between rotations and a real electromagnetic field. So I'm going to write down now, actually, for a rotating system, I'm going to write down E of phi. E of phi is equal to d squared ddx, h bar squared divided by 2n. And then there's going to be a grad minus, and then there's going to be a im divided by h bar omega cross r. All this applied to phi, absolute value squared. That's the kinetic part. And then the other part, mu rho 0 minus plus half g rho 0 squared is the traction part.
Excuse me.
Yes?
To interpret what we've just written, is the phi here the phi that we've been using to characterize our weakly entrapped photon system?
Yes.
OK, so our, and here we are thinking that there is no external magnetic field imposed on it.
Rotation. But it's the same. I could put here instead of B, and then it will be a gauge potential for a constant magnetic field B. So in the Landau gauge, A is a half B cross R. I think that's the right order. If I take the rotor of A, I'll get B. Okay? That's just a simple gauge. Here, coming from Coriolis. OK, so now, what is the solution of this equation? Well, this equation wants the phase to rotate. It wants the gradient not to be 0, the grad phi. In fact, I can write this, right? But the question is, can I make this gradient of phi, okay, let me write this
as h bar squared rho 0 divided by 2m. And here I'll have grad phi minus im, minus m divided by h bar omega cross r. Can I make this vanish? This is the velocity. Well, the answer is no, I can't make it vanish, but I can make it small. How do I make it small? I'll allow grad phi to rotate around a certain point, and that's called the vortex. So I'll allow a vortex solution, which is given by phi of x, goes like square root of rho of x, e to the minus, e to the minus or plus, what do I like to put here? Put plus. I k phi of x, that's a particular function. This is the, what's called the angle function. So how do I draw it? I'll just decide to give constant phases to constant angles from the origin. This is x minus x of the vortex. So let's say the origin is at the position x vortex. And now I'm drawing equal phase contours. Equal phase contours are just straight radial lines. This is phi equals 0. This is phi equals 45 degrees, 90 degrees, and so on. As you can see, the phase winds around 2 pi. I can make it wind around k times 2 pi. So k is an index of how much vorticity I have. Rho of x, I want the function to be smooth and continuous. So rho x has to vanish for x. This goes to 0 for x equal to x vortex. So there is some kind of a profile for this function. And that profile has to be determined from this energy by minimizing with respect to all the possible profiles. You'll get a differential equation that will be solved to give you rho of x. I'll just give you the solution. It's not worth doing the variational analysis here. But you get some function that looks like, if this is rho, it depends on the radius r. R is the absolute value of x minus the x vortex. And rho of r behaves like this. The typical size of the core, where the density goes to 0, and it reaches rho 0, the asymptotic limit, at a distance which is related to psi. You remember I told you that this energy functional has a typical length scale called psi. That exactly is what will determine the core size of the vortices. Yes?
Would you mind
putting
x of these
location vortex? Okay, so you decide to put the vortex in a particular point in space, large x of the vortex, and I want the field everywhere else. The field is determined relative to this position. The angle is relative to the position. That's the phase. And the dependence of the density relative to that position. So it decays at r equals 0, which is x equal to xv.
Why should the field vanish for the vortex?
This should vanish. It's not the field. It's the magnitude should vanish. Otherwise, it won't be continuous. This is extremely non-continuous. If you look at this function, you see phi is jumping from 0 to pi at this point, right? So there's a lot of discontinuity in this part of the function. But discontinuity costs me in gradient energy. There's a gradient here. So the solution that will minimize the energy will actually have a vanishing density at the core. That's the vortex solution. The vortex solution is topological. You can detect it by looking at the phase winding very, very far away from where it's at. And you'll find that when you take line integrals of the gradient of the phase, dl grad phi, you simply get 2 pi k. Okay? So it's a topological singularity. It costs energy. If you plug in this vortex solution in here, you'll get a vortex energy. And However, the vortex energy will be lower than not putting a vortex and paying a large amount. If you don't put the vortex and set, for instance, gradient phi to zero, you'll get omega squared r squared integral over space. You get a diverging energy that is essentially very high, and the system would like to create a vortex in order to reduce the energy. So this is the reason vortices are formed. Okay? So if I now plug in this solution into here, I'll get that the energy of a vortex is given by okay, before I do the energy, I want the current. What is the current flowing around the vortex? Well, the current is simply rho zero. Okay, let me write down this function. Okay, I'll write it rho of x. It's rho of x, the density at position x. This is the current at position x. It's rho of x times a gradient here, h bar gradient divided by n, so you'll get h bar times k okay, I need to do one more derivation before I show that. What is the gradient of phi? Gradient of phi is simply phi hat divided by r. Okay? Just a second, I want to make sure. Yeah, gradient of phi is phi hat divided by r. That you can simply do in few different ways. If I look at the origin and a point here that has angle phi, and gradient of phi is a vector that goes along phi hat, right? Because it's the phi is changing by rotation. If you take how much it's changing, then this distance here is r times d phi. Right? So the gradient will be 1 over r phi hat. That's very simple to get. So when I do that and I use this gradient of phi, I get that J is equal to rho of x times h bar divided by m. This is k times phi, so I get k divided by r minus omega times r. Now, omega cross r is also in the direction of phi hat. So it's omega times r. All this guy is multiplied by phi hat, but I'm taking the absolute. Okay, so this is now the direction of j. So you see j is in the direction of phi hat, and if I draw it, it'll be circles like this around the origin, which is xv. But you can see that as you go to larger distances, in the beginning, let's say for very small distances, this dominates. But at a certain distance, which is typical for this equation, the current vanishes. J equal to zero at the distance, which is determined by h bar k divided by m r, is equal to omega r. So r would be h bar k divided by m omega to the half. So given a certain magnetic field or rotation, the vortex current will go down, down, down until it reaches zero. And then it turns negative. Now what we will find is that for very weak rotations, we can make a single vortex in the system by just tuning this radius to be the size of the system. But if the size of the system is infinite, I'll have to put more vortices in there because I'll start paying energy on these currents that are increasing. So the system will put additional vortices. The amount of vortices that you'll get in is proportional to this rotation. Okay? We don't have a transparency. Okay, I'll show it next to me. Okay. So now the only question is how to find this profile function. And as I said, I'm not going to do that. It takes too long and it's not very instructive. I'll just give you the answer. This function here, rho of r, essentially is very well approximated by, it's very well approximated by r divided by psi squared, 1 plus r divided by psi squared. Kind of a Lorentz, yeah? At large r, this goes to 1, so this is times rho 0. This is, I would say, an approximate form of the vortex. It increases linearly, quadratically here. Quadratically. At low, small r, and then it decays as a power law, 1 over r squared, to the asymptotic limit. And when you plug in this solution into this expression, you'll get some number. And that number is called the core energy of the vortex. So what's the price in energy to get in the vortex? And that depends on how the magnetic field exactly matches the boundary conditions and how many vortices you put in and so on. So that's the story of the vortex. Why is the vortex so important? The vortex is important because it will eventually tell us how superconductivity gets destroyed. This is the first effect of destroying superconductivity. It's putting a defect in the order parameter. This is a defect, singularity, and this defect is topological, you can feel it. This defect interacts with other defects. And it's quite an interesting story of how it interacts with other defects. You can actually write down theory of interacting vortices very easily because it has a complete analogy to electrostatics. And that's actually quite beautiful. The theory of vortices looks like the theory of charges, of Coulomb charges in two dimensions. And I'll show you why that's true. But before that, I want to show you what is the response of a vortex like this when you try to flow a current in the system. Yes?
When you talked about how at a certain R value, J turns to zero, beyond that R value, it's negative, how does this generate more vortices?
Because that becomes a bad solution. If the size of the system is larger than this R, then the currents here start to grow in the opposite direction. And when currents flow, this energy, which is essentially the current squared, increases. So you have to put more vortices, that's all. So a system with a finite magnetic field, which is large, has many vortices. In fact, there's a close relation between the magnetic field and the density of vortices, but we'll do that later. Yeah.
So it seems that we could have done exactly the same analysis in that the case of that magnetic field, basically the same magnetic field, or where?
Okay. So yes, you could have done exactly the same analysis, and the question is there a vortex or not? Is a question of energetics. If you put a magnetic field and it decays in the bulk, and the cost in electromagnetic energy is still lower than creating vortices, you won't have vortices. If the cost is higher, you will create vortices. So there are two phases of superconductors, with and without vortices. One is called the Meissner phase, and the other is called the vortex phase.
And what determines what is more favorable?
Okay, so I said in two dimensions, it's always favorable to put vortices in. I didn't do the analysis of how much energy a vortex costs, but it does depend on dimensionality, right? You, if you have a third dimension to integrate over, this number starts increasing with the length of in the third dimension. And then you have to do the electrodynamics, which I don't do, is how much magnetic energy you're losing by repelling the magnetic field. So you have to do a serious calculation of what are the field lines doing outside your sample. You're squeezing them. That costs you also energy. The actual experiment, when you take a superconducting cube and you put it in a magnetic field, in the Meissner phase, the magnetic field is doing this. Okay? This costs you energy. There are, essentially, this system is producing a magnetization which is precisely canceling the magnetic field here. Here B is equal to zero. And that is the balance you have to do to the energy that they calculated here, which was the matter energy, not the electrodynamics energy. So, again, all this, as I said, is not something I want to cover too deeply because it's very experimental oriented and it's also covered very well in much thicker textbooks than I have time to talk about here. But the basic idea is simply minimizing this functional plus the electromagnetism. That's all. There's nothing more than that. This functional, actually, I should give it its name. It's called the Ginzburg-Landau theory. So this E of phi is called Ginzburg-Landau. And it has an interesting history. Ginzburg-Landau theory was written in the Soviet Union to explain superconductivity exactly with this kind of a form. They used different parameters, but the form was the same. It was this kind of a, if you want, ddx. There was a, let me write it down the way. A half rho s grad phi minus q over h bar ca squared minus mu, and then this is the order parameter squared plus g over 2 order parameter fourth plus order parameter 6. It's a low order parameter expansion. So in principle, there should have been higher order terms, but the most important ones are these. If you take these two together, you can write them as a Mexican hat, it's called. G over 2, phi squared minus mu over g squared plus constant, minus mu squared over g squared, etc. If you look at this, if you look at this form says, I have some kind of a potential as a function of the magnitude of phi. Well, phi is a complex variable, so this looks like a double well if I take, let's say, phi in the real axis. The real part looks like a x squared minus a constant, all that squared. That's this kind of a potential. And now it has a symmetry because this is a complex number. It's an absolute value of a complex value, so it's actually a, if you want, this kind of a, it's exactly the kind of potential we saw in the XY model. You have this kind of a Mexican hat where the system wants to break symmetry and point somewhere in the Mexican hat direction. That will be the particular direction, square root of rho, 0, and they'll have an angle e to the I phi, which will be this angle phi. And this term is the stiffness term. And the reason they wrote this expression is because they want to explain the phenomenology of the Meissner effect, which I explained to you before. And then they got out of it flux quantization. But the original mistake was to put here charge E because they said we're talking about electrons. And in fact, it was 2E because eventually it was learned that it's not electrons, it's pairs of electrons. But this is called the Ginzburg-Landau theory. And as you can see, when you do it in coherent states, it's simply an expectation value in coherent state. But at the time, they didn't use coherent states. They didn't use all the notions that we got from Bose condensation. You just wrote it down, essentially assuming some field, phi of x, complex, to describe what's going on. Okay? This introduction of a field, a scalar numerical field, to describe what's going on in a thermodynamic system, was first applied to a superconductor, and then it turned out you can apply it to all statistical mechanics problems. And Ginzburg-Landau became actually a way of describing thermodynamics of magnetic systems and charge systems and solids, and all the interesting phases of matter can be understood in terms of functionals. But there was always this missing gap between functionals of fields and quantum mechanics, which describe operators. The way I introduced it through coherent states, you can see the connection. But at the time, it was always a mystery. What is this function? Unfortunately, in the literature, people use the word wave function for this. And I'm putting it in quotation mark in order to warn you. It's not a wave function of any sort. It's true that when you minimize this, it looks like a Schrödinger equation, but it's nothing to do with the Schrödinger equation. It's like a minimizing directions of vectors in the Heisenberg model. Those vectors don't describe any wave function. They're just classical configurations. It's true I'm using complex numbers here. I could have used two real fields. It doesn't matter. But it's just fields representing variational states that happen to give me low energy. And it's very confusing and misleading to think about these fields as wave functions the same way as thinking about electric fields and magnetic fields as wave functions. They're not. You could use them to simulate wave functions, but they're not quantum mechanical wave functions, or they don't represent any Dirac state, okay, or Dirac kit. So, but there's words of this in the literature, and I just want to warn you. Another thing that's kind of a misnomer is this coefficient here was called superfluid density. Now, in the derivation I showed you before, indeed, rho zero had to do with the density of bosons. But this expression is true not only for weakly interacting bosons, but for lattice bosons too, and for magnetic problems and many other cases where the coefficient has nothing to do with density of anything. Okay? It's a combination there that comes in, h bar, rho zero, 2m. And all these numbers can have no physical meaning whatsoever, except that they come in a combination that would appear in the Meissner effect and give you the London penetration there. But they don't tell you about number of particles superfluid density. In superconductors, this number has nothing to do with the number of Cooper pairs or number of bosons in the system. It's just a number, okay? And actually a very large one in superconductor. But in weakly interacting Bose gas, where this terminology came from, it was used because of this expression over there to call it superfluid density. So I want to eradicate all these misnomers and bad notations that confuse people endlessly. Okay, and now I'll teach you why planes fly. Okay? Do you wonder ever when you take flight? Why does the plane fly? Or does it bother you? Me, it bothers because I'm never sure that I exactly understand. But what I'm going to teach you is something from the medieval times called Magnus Force. Magnus Force is a force of a flow on a vortex. Let me do that. When I pass a current in a superfluid, it's very similar to passing a current in a wind tunnel where I have a vortex in the middle. What will happen? I need something to be trace of the. So that's the problem when you clean the board so well. Okay. It's very easy to calculate these things with the formulations that we derive. And historically, the formulation that I'm writing down, all these Ginzburg-Landau and hydrodynamics equations, were well known to physicists who knew fluid dynamics. They introduced, actually, all these equations. Essentially, my energy, if I want to write it simply in terms of physical observable, is a half, a mass, an integral dgx, v squared, plus things that depend on density, minus mu rho 0 plus g over 2 rho squared, which I don't care about because I want to minimize effect of flow. V, as I said, is h bar grad phi minus all this stuff with the gauge field, q over h bar ca. And I want to minimize that. But now I want to add a certain physical ingredient. Yes?
If we're still talking about the.
It's a bit rosy one.
It'll be interacting bosons.
Yeah, interacting bosons. Yeah.
Where did our phis go?
Phi became
okay,
the rho 0, and the angle became v.
So are we assuming ground state energies, or around the ground state energies, since we're using rho naught?
We're minimizing the energy with respect to phi. Actually, that's the only variable we can play with now, because the density is fixed by these two terms. So how do, okay, so I want to minimize the energy with respect to phi, but what I want to discuss is a boundary condition. And a boundary condition is that I'm actually moving the system with velocity v, because I'm essentially discussing v prime, which is v minus vs. I want to move moving frame, and I want to get what is the energy going to be of the system when I have a backflow of a current, when I have a flow of current. So my calculation is the following. Here's a vortex sitting here peacefully, and now I'm making the system have a finite velocity here. So how would I solve this problem? I can say, fine, I can just work in the lab frame, get the energy, or I can work in the moving frame, and now my vortex is moving with respect to some background velocity, and I'll just plug this into here and get the new energy and see the difference. And I want to find the dependence of the difference in terms of ES, and of course what I'll get is that this is equal to half m rho 0 dvx v prime squared plus 2 v prime v, sorry, minus 2 v prime v, plus v squared, vs squared. Okay? Plus the density terms that don't change. So I'll get essentially the energy of the stationary vortex minus 2 times an integral dvx times m rho, okay, the 2 will go away, there'll be m rho 0 v dot vs. And I want to calculate this integral, that's all. And the question is how to calculate this integral. Well, v, as you see, is written in this form. A is equal to 0. There's no rotations here. A is equal to 0. Throw this away. So delta E, this term, is an integral m rho 0 p dx and rho 0 grad phi dot ds. Integral over all space. Question is how to calculate this integral. Remember that phi describes now a vortex. But what I find is that actually I want to regularize this problem because a single vortex is a bit of a problem. So I'll draw the configuration I'm thinking about, and I want to calculate this integral. The answer is very simple, but it's a bit subtle how you regularize the problem. So imagine I have a vortex here at xv. The vortex will give me these equal phases going this way. But I don't know how to do the integral from infinity to minus infinity to infinity when phases are changing everywhere on the whole lattice. So what I'll do is I'll put here an antivortex. Now the phases will behave like this. Now, what will happen here is the phase here could be considered zero. That's picking a gauge. I'm picking phi equals zero everywhere. Here, it's 45, and here it's, I'm assuming now k is equal to 1. The vorticity is just 1. So here's just the angles, right? So it's 135 degrees, 180, and this is 270, or 200 degrees, 330, so on. These are lines of equal phase, and here the phase goes down. It starts at 180, and it goes down to 135, 45, and so on. So the phase winds in this direction. The current goes this way. Here, the current goes this way. That's a vortex. This is an antivortex. Now I want to calculate this integral. This integral is essentially given by dx. dy of grad phi dot v. Okay, so I just want to look at this part. This is a vector. Actually, this vector, if I multiply it by h bar, this vector is the total momentum of the superfluid. Very important number. Okay, one always has to know how to calculate momentum and stuff. So momentum here is given by this integral. It looks deceivingly simple, and it is simple to calculate, but it's a bit tricky to show how you do it. So what I'll do is I'll take this in the direction this is x, this is y. This distance here is xv minus x0. That's this distance. And I'm doing the integral by taking slabs dx, delta x. And now I'm doing this integral. So how do I do the integral? I take the integral from minus infinity to infinity dy. So I'll get p in the y direction is given by integral of dx minus infinity to infinity. Let's call it, dx. And then integral dy minus infinity to infinity d phi dy. Okay, that's an easy integral to calculate because if I'm sitting here, and I'm going and I'm doing this integral dy. So an integral of the derivative of phi between minus infinity and infinity will be how many times I wound the angle phi around the origin. I start here at phi equals 0. I end at phi equals 0. That's boundary conditions. On the way, the angle hasn't changed much. It will probably go a little bit positive, a little bit negative, back to 0. It won't wind around. This will be 0. as long as I'm sitting on the right hand of the vortex. You can convince yourself that even if I'm very close to the vortex here, whatever I'm winding in one direction, this is my angle, I'm going up, I'm coming down, I'm going the other way, I'm coming up, I'm coming to zero. I'm not winding. There's zero winding number for any of these integrals as long as I don't hit the vortex. Now, let me look at an integral here. An integral here will wind 2 pi. You can see that because I'm starting at zero, I'm going down to 330 degrees, 180, 135, 45, zero. This does this. It gives me 2 pi. And all these integrals give me 2 pi until I hit this vortex. And then it gives me zero. So the result of this integral is going to be integral dx minus infinity to infinity, 2 pi. If I want to put k here for winding, I can put even k. It's the same idea. Times a theta function of x minus x antivortex minus theta function of x minus x vortex. So I can easily do the x integral. And I get 2 pi k times x vortex minus x antivortex. This is py. What about px? Px is 0. Because if I go from this direction, and I go from this direction, because I'm hitting the vortex and the antivortex, I'll get winding in one way, winding back. You can convince yourself this is 0. So px is equal to 0. Now, I did this calculation by choosing my x and y properly to be exactly parallel to the distance between vortex and antivortex. But you can now rotate this calculation any axis you want, and you get the general result, which is given as follows. Actually, I forgot the factor of rho 0, so I'll put it back. My momentum of a vortex and an antivortex is given by the 2 pi times h bar will give me h. K is the vorticity. Rho 0, superfluid density. And then x vortex cross z hat. Plus something that depends, some p0 that depends on the position of the antivortex that I don't care about, because now I just want to move the vortex. So it's actually xv minus xv bar, but I'm separating. This is the term that I'm interested in. That's the momentum. And my energy, my delta energy, is simply it's simply the momentum dot vs, which is going to be hk rho 0. And now let me write it the following way. X dot, okay, I'll do it slowly. X cross z dot vs, which you can change the order of scalar products and cross product, but in x dot z cross vs. That's the delta energy. What does this mean? This means that the position of the vortex determines the energy. The more I move the vortex, the linear the energy grows in this particular form. So a question I can easily ask is, how much energy will I gain by moving a little bit the vortex? That's called the Magnus force. F Magnus, named after a medieval, well, kind of a contemporary of Bernoulli, maybe a bit later, a physicist, very smart guy, who was thinking about wind and water motion. The Magnus force would be given by the minus gradient with respect to x vortex of this energy, delta E. That's how much force I get if I move the vortex a little bit. So what is it going to be? Take the gradient of this guy, and you get this is equal to h k rho 0 z cross vx. What Magnus didn't know is that vortices are integer number of h, because he didn't know about Planck's constant. But he had a quantity here called vorticity, classical vorticity. That's the solution of rotor of V that gives you this number. And except for this quantization of vortices into integer number of h, this equation was given by him. Why do airplanes fly? Because of this equation. And this goes contrary to what you see in science museums when they explain to you why airplanes fly.
So how does this result explain how things fly?
What?
How does this result explain how things fly?
I'll show you. So at least, if you're not interested in condensed matter physics, you'll get something out of this course. Okay. So actually, Bernoulli, not Bernoulli, Magnus thought about a cylinder that is rotating with velocity omega. And this velocity, because the cylinder is a bit kind of rough, causes currents to flow around. And therefore, a vortex will be created by rotating the cylinder. And now, imagine you blow on the cylinder. So you put this Vx, this velocity here. What will happen? OK, well, this is the vortex. This is the velocity. Z cross the velocity will give me a force upwards. So the Magnus force is perpendicular to the flow. It doesn't want to push, like you naively think, the wind comes and pushes. It wants to move the cylinder this way. Yes, it would like to move the cylinder this way, but the rotation makes the cylinder want to move upward. What do you mean wants to move? It doesn't necessarily move there. It means there's a force that if the dynamics allow, it will move there. And this is actually an elevation force. Now, why is this related to a wing of an airplane? Wing of an airplane is built in this form. Okay? Most important part of the wing is this. So the story you always get is that wind comes here. And here it has to kind of go on a longer path to join this guy. And since it goes on a longer path, there's a stronger current here. And there's an energy that is essentially half mv squared, exactly the same energies that we have here for superfluids. It's laminar flow. The energy is higher here than here. So the wing would like to go up and reduce the energy by eliminating some of the liquid, some of the air that's here to reduce the energy. And that's the force of elevation on a wing. Okay? But that's not the right story. Why? Because if you started the flow very, very, very slowly and you looked at how the flow will go, the flow will actually go like this. And the velocities will be the same, and there will be no Magnus force. So what really happens in an airplane is you're creating vorticity on the wing. You're starting to fly, and this kind of a sharp edge wants to be the place where vortices are created. It's created because the velocities are highest, and that's why you can break the vorticity barrier and create vortices. So if you join the wings here, then there's a net vorticity around the wing. The faster you flow, the higher this vorticity. The higher the vorticity, the higher the Magnus force. So what you get here is actually the vorticity times Vs in this direction. Okay, understood? So it's the planning of the wing to have the anti-vortices that are formed, because this, when you create a vortex, you have to create an anti-vortex, otherwise you're doing something topological on the whole space. So you're creating a vortex this way and an anti-vortex this way, and these anti-vortices go downstream. Anybody that watches the eddy of a boat when you travel will see that the boat keeps emitting anti-vortices that go downstream. It's a very similar effect. So emission of anti-vortices, increasing the vorticity here, is the reason that you can get a force on the wing that wants to push the wing up. Okay? It's also used in sails and many other important hydrodynamic objects. But why is it relevant to superconductors? If I have a vortex system and I'm flowing a current here, J, after a while, the current just dislodges the vortices. If the vortex here is not pinned very hard, it wants to move because of the Magnus force. And when you increase J above a critical value, JC, very important for superconductors, because above that value, the system stops being superconductor. Why does it stop being a superconductor? Because the vortices start flowing across the system. And these are like the breaking of the rigidity I was describing before that will actually cause a potential drop. And a voltage will be created from one side to the other that's related to how many vortices are moving and at what speed. So I'll discuss this tomorrow, transport theory of moving vortices, and summarize. Yes?
So the plane, why is the anti-vortex associated to the body of the plane, but not the vortex? So the vortex is an anti-vortex, and vortex anti-vortex creation, right? And the vortex,
the point of joining, the point of joining wants to be, okay, going beyond my expertise, wants to be at the sharpest point on the wing. It doesn't want to be here. It's unstable here, the creation of vortices. So let's say what this process is, if the vortices of the air are quantized, okay, what will happen is the point will move up, there won't be any Magnus force, and suddenly this point will shift downwards, and by shifting downwards, you'll create an anti-vortex. So it'll be a constantly shifting the joint the joining position back and forth every time you emit an anti-vortex.
So is the downstream the anti-vortex or the which?
The anti-vortex is created here in free space. And since there's no boundaries for it to attach to, remember there's also continuity equations here that the pressure on the boundary has to be constant, and therefore that's a boundary condition on the flow too. So here you don't have this boundary condition, so the anti-vortex will just dissipate, go downhill, and fly with the front wing. In aerodynamics, there's dissipation. In superfluidity, there's no dissipation. So that's a big, big difference in actual equations. Energy can dissipate. Here, I haven't shown, because I didn't do the dynamics yet, I haven't shown conservation of energy, but all superfluid phenomena are in principle energy conserving. There's no dissipative mechanisms unless you introduce them in the dynamics. And you can't fly in a superfluid. Okay? Because, first of all, it costs you to create an anti-vortex. And if you don't cross that barrier, then you won't have the Magnus. You won't have vorticity here. But the second, even if you have vorticity, it'll be stuck in a certain number. It won't change according to your velocity like it does in hydrodynamics. The history of connection between hydrodynamics and the Schrödinger equation is very interesting. Schrödinger himself was an expert in sound propagation and in hydrodynamics. He wrote the equation based on analogies he had from hydrodynamics. He wrote essentially the only equation he knew for current and conservation, and because he knew that there's supposed to be probability conservation, then he wrote the equation for the probability density exactly in the form that you would write the equation for number density in a liquid. Except you wrote a linear equation, because he wanted to find eigenvalues and quantize them. So he took essentially from hydrodynamics the kinetic part and the linear part, and he didn't have this phi to the fourth term, and that was his motivation for the Schrödinger equation. So you see, everything ties together. I think I've bothered you enough today, huh?